Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research with unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And on our show today, we'll be talking with Professor and Director of Cardiac Electrophysiology and Pacing at UNC, Dr. Paul Mounsey, about arrhythmias. How's your heart beating today, Adam?
I don't know. Electrophysiology and pacing, those are some fancy words there. And arrhythmia, oh, my goodness. But you know what? I run a lot, Christy, and I've been worried a little bit about how fast can I get my heart rate up to without being dangerous. I'm going to make sure I asked Dr. Mounsey about this.
Well, first, we have some good research that matters. We're going to talk about a little bit about birth control and about vitamins to boost memory.
Or not.
And about injuries to athletes impacting their thinking skills.
And finally, mouth washing and pregnancy, can it prevent prematurity? Very interesting research. Let's talk about our very first one today about a new public policy that's gone into play for women and getting preventive services like birth control.
Yeah, well, this is more of a policy conversation, Adam, but I think as much as we both believe in prevention and that this is a very positive statement to talk about. So this is the Institute of Medicine passing that government-approved birth control methods should be included in the U.S. list of preventive health services. It's required coverage that would also include free screenings for gestational diabetes, counseling for HIV and STDs or sexually transmitted infections, STIs, screening for domestic violence.
Yeah, so the co-payments, so what you would have to pay out of pocket to get these preventive care services. And particularly the biggest one really here is if a woman desires and her physician recommends that she get birth control and all forms of birth control, these are covered and you no longer have a co-payment for these. And so this is a potentially removes, I think, a large barrier for women to come in and get needed preventive services and unwanted pregnancies.
Well, it's true. I mean, this is a very common scenario where a young person either is married or not married and sexually active and not wanting to be pregnant, and paying for the birth control can really be a barrier. And so I'm pleased to see that this is an opportunity for some people to be able to prevent unwanted pregnancy.
And I assume it's really for any forms of birth control, so whether it would be birth control pills or diaphragm or
IUD.
IUD. Yeah, that's right. And we're going to actually post online these new guidelines that are published. I know the website is www.hrsa.gov/women's guidelines. We're going to put a link to that as well.
Yeah, our librarians at the Health Sciences Library can help us with that.
Great. What's our very next research that matters about vitamins and memory boosting?
So this is a study that, I take a little with a grain of salt, looking at 4,500 French men and women between the ages of 40 to 60 years old who took vitamin and mineral supplements. So they had vitamin C, E, selenium, zinc, beta carotene, took those for 8 years, and to see if that had made any difference on their thinking and memory.
Yeah, and they compared it with a group that took a placebo pill that didn't have these nutrients in it every day, and people didn't know which pill they were taking. And so it's a rigorous design and followed for a long period of time. So in the past, Christy, when we've looked at some of this research, we really have increasingly seen doubts about some of the benefits of this type of supplements on people's health. And they claim that there was a boost in memory here. But what did they actually report?
Well, they found that the groups who took the supplement and the placebo really did similarly on most tests. But the ones who took the nutrients They did a little bit better on one test of long-term memory. So they had to recall words in different categories and see if they could remember them later.
And this doesn't – I guess it sounds like to you and maybe to myself, this isn't – we take this with a grain of salt because this is not the sort of a, you know, significant finding that really is clinically necessarily relevant. And it may not actually be true because when you test multiple hypotheses, you can statistically have one be – true just by chance alone. So you can look this up in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, but I don't I'm not overly impressed, and I based on this, particularly in light of the other research, I am not recommending this sort of multivitamin for memory boost. I think it's wishful thinking.
Yeah, good to eat a nice, healthy, well-balanced diet.
Find those vitamins from your fresh fruits and vegetables.
Yep.
What's
okay.
The very next research that matters?
So this is about injuries in athletes, not the concussion head injuries that we're used to talking about impacting thinking, but a study looking at other injuries and a link to problems in thinking.
Yeah, this was in the American Journal of Sports Medicine. And, you know, we're so in tune with head trauma in our athletes and that their disordered thinking, that's one sign of a potential concussion. But the real question is any real injury in an athlete where they pull a muscle, sprain an ankle, well, what happens in those circumstances with their thinking? Because maybe the disordered thinking is actually due to an injury, not just limited to a head trauma.
So researchers at the University of Toronto gave this 20-minute computer test to like 72 different athletes, football, hockey, lacrosse players, a bunch of them. Some of them had had a concussion in the past few days. But the other had had like a muscle injury or a tendon injury. And they found that the folks, even the ones who didn't have head injuries, did worse than the healthy comparison group on some of the tests.
Right. And these people who had had the muscle or tendon injury did not do as bad as those who had had a head injury, but it still was a marker for disordered thinking. And this raises the real question that after, you know, if you're an athlete and you sprain an ankle in an athletic competition, should you go right back in even after that ankle's taped? Should there be some test about the thinking because maybe you're not ready to go right back in for pain or because of you're distracted?
Yeah, you wonder, is it just that their body is sort of distracted, their mind is distracted by that pain? The blood flow maybe needs to go there instead of to the
brain. You're more likely to get a concussion or have a re-injury. So
well,
I think this
concerning.
Raises some questions for Christy and I. It makes us a little bit more circumspect about sending an athlete back in to competition after really any significant injury.
So this next research is about mouthwashing in pregnancy.
Say that again, Chris.
I don't know if I can. Mouthwashing moms are, in this study, less likely to have premature labor and premature baby. So what we know is that gum disease is very common and it can get worse in pregnancy and that it is linked with preterm labor.
Yeah, and this article that was in the American Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology looked at 71 pregnant women who had gum disease, and they rinsed twice a day for 30 seconds with a mouthwash that didn't contain alcohol. And they then looked at this group compared to a group of pregnant women who also had gum disease but rinsed only with water and looked at the rates of preterm labor.
And they found that in the water-only group, about 1 in 5 delivered their babies prematurely. But in the mouthwash group, 4 mothers total, so it was 1 in 20, delivered their babies prematurely. So it appeared, although it's not blinded, the moms knew whether they got mouthwash or not, it appeared that rinsing with this mouthwash decreased their risk of delivering a premature baby significantly.
And Christy and I have done shows about really mouth disease and gum disease being a marker for lots of systemic problems. Though we should say that this was funded by Procter & Gamble, the company that markets the particular mouthwash in the study. And so I guess the bottom line here, Christy, is mouthwash safe to use in pregnancy, assuming that it's not swallowed? Is there any downside to it for women who have gum disease or not?
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't sound like there's a lot of risk to it other than cost. And certainly if you don't have gum disease, then it's unlikely it's going to help just by common sense. But if you do have gum disease, it doesn't seem like there's a lot of risk to it other than the cost.
And I'm not delivering babies now. I'd still like to see a little bit more research, see it replicated by groups that doesn't have a financial tie here. But
premature delivery is such a big deal that if you can extend that even a little bit, that is a good thing. So,
well, that's going to conclude our research that matters. We've had a nice chance to talk about mouthwash and prematurity.
Talking about insurances fully covering birth control.
The new changes about any sort of injury and whether you maybe should not rush to go back into that competition, but take a time out.
And about, can vitamins help boost your memory?
And we're both a little suspect about that particular research finding. So
we are. That does conclude our Research That Matters portion of the show. After the break, we'll be talking with Dr. Paul Mounsey about arrhythmias. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy and I are talking with Dr. Paul Mounsey, Professor and Director of Cardiac Electrophysiology and Pacing at the University of North Carolina School of Medicine, about arrhythmias, a topic that actually is increasingly, I think, important to Americans. And I don't know if it's because arrhythmias are increasing or the perception is that more and more people have them. Welcome to the show, Dr. Mounsey. Let's dive right in.
Thanks very much. Yeah, I think it's actually an increasing awareness among the population about their hearts. I think that, and I think we'll be talking hitting on sudden death a little bit later. But I think people are beginning to realize that the commonest cause of death in the United States today is sudden cardiac death, and that is usually an arrhythmia problem. So people's general awareness of arrhythmias as a result of that is increasing throughout the community, and I can't think that is anything but a good thing.
So just to give our listeners some context, you are an expert in cardiology, an expert in arrhythmias. How did you become so passionate about the heart and about how it beats?
I suppose it dates back to when I first entered medical school, and at a very early stage, I kind of realized that the heart was at the center of our existence. And then I had the opportunity to spend 2 or 3 years doing research into how the electrical impulse was generated by the cardiac cell. And that was really before I became a physician. And I've been passionate about it ever since. So it kind of was inevitable that I would end up here studying human arrhythmias.
Well, how did you end up in Chapel Hill? Because somehow that accent that I'm detecting doesn't sound like a native North Carolinian.
No. I always tell people this is my Virginia accent because I was at the University of Virginia for several years before I came here. But obviously also in the background, I came from the other side of the pond and grew up there. But I've been in the southeastern United States for the majority of my clinical practicing career, and I just retained the accent.
Your training was in London?
My training was in Great Britain. I did part of my training in London and part of my training in Oxford.
So maybe we'll get a chance to hear a little bit about if the management of this or people's awareness, is it any different cross-culturally, or is this a issue of Western civilization or not in terms of arrhythmias?
I rather think it's mainly it's a symptom of Western civilization, of people as people increase their awareness of their health. But I would hesitate to put myself forward as an expert on British healthcare because I haven't done any of it for the last 25 years.
Well, I have two questions that come to mind. I'll ask the first one. How do you explain to patients or to our listeners when we say arrhythmia, what is that?
An arrhythmia is an abnormal rhythm of the heart, and that means that the heart is either going too fast, too slow, or irregularly. But more than that, because we all know that when we're running, the heart rate could go up, if you're 18 or 19, could go up to practically 200 beats a minute, and that would be abnormal in an older person. So not only must the heart be either too fast or too slow or irregular, but it must be doing it in a pathological way.
So something is going wrong with how the heart is beating.
Yes.
Okay. And the next question and follow-up is that I bet a lot of our listeners are thinking, sometimes I feel my heart doing funny beats. And that's one of the really common things that patients come to me and to Adam, and I'm sure to you about
and also,
too.
And also to me. And I think that one of the things that we all have to realize is that when the human heart was being designed, it was not designed to beat regularly. It's perfectly normal in a perfectly normal, healthy person for the heart to miss a beat every now and then, and for the heart to put in extra thumping loud beats every now and then. If they're happening no more than 3 or 4 times a minute and they're not making you feel ill, and there's nothing else wrong with your heart, it's extremely unlikely that beats like that mean anything. We all kind of have this idea, I think, that we were brought up to expect a regular pulse from when we were born to when we die, but it's actually not true. That's not the way the heart was designed. For the upper chambers, the atria of the heart, to put in an extra beat every now and then, which may reset the pacemaker of the heart such that the heart takes a little time to pick up again, or indeed for the lower chambers of the heart to do the same thing, is quite normal, and people sense that in different ways. They may feel a double beat followed by a pause, or they may just feel a pause. Generally, at this point, when I'm talking to patients, I start banging my chest. My wife tells me I have a permanently bruised chest because I bang my chest quite a lot to describe it. I don't think that would come out very well on the radio, though.
Well, maybe we'll do it at the end with the new movie, the Planet of the Apes and the Return. But let me ask this question because, you know, we describe what's called palpitations with this kind of this sensation of these extra beats. But for some people, these are incredibly debilitating. I had a patient of mine hospitalized this week who's had longstanding palpitations, and we talk about them. And he comes into the doctor, and he continues to be disturbed by them despite reassurance that these aren't really going to hurt him. So what distinguishes people who really perceive this and it really bothers them, and then what can we do about that?
I think that I meet people who have palpitations. And what does palpitations mean? It means that you can actually feel your heart beating. That's really all it means. It doesn't mean that there's anything wrong with the rhythm of your heart. Palpitations simply means that you can feel your heart beating, because after all, we're not supposed to feel our heart beating, are we? And I must say that assuming that there is no pathological rhythm of the heart and assuming that there is no heart disease, palpitations are almost always completely benign. And I spend a lot of my life reassuring people that irregularities of the pulse mean anything. It's very common for example, when people lie down in bed at night and they put their head on the pillow and they're lying on their left side, so the heart's scrunched up against the chest wall, for them to feel palpitations, because there's nothing else to listen to. You can hear your heart beating in your left ear as you're on your left side. Your heart's scrunched up against your chest wall on the left side, and every little funny thing the heart does, you feel it.
So what do you tell those people? Turn on your right side?
A lot of people who are bothered by this find that turning on their right side doesn't cure it, but because it's still happening, but they notice it less, or lying on their back. I honestly think that's almost a Band-Aid solution. I think that the real solution to the problem is to help people recognize that these are just variants of normality in the vast majority of cases. And, you know, sometimes people find, for example, relaxation techniques can help them go away. Some people have told me they find yoga can help them go away. Anything that takes away, that helps you to cope with the anxiety. Of course, we can make them go away with pills, but I really try very hard not to use pills for benign palpitations. We can certainly administer medications of various kinds that will usually make them go away, but really all you're doing is giving a pill for something that is part of normality, which doesn't strike me as a very sensible thing to do.
Well, we are going to have to take a break in just a second, but some people feel their heart racing, and that could be a sign of a real arrhythmia, of something that's not normal. So how do you advise people to distinguish the sort of normal feeling of your heart versus if it's really going 160 beats a minute and it's not supposed to?
And I want to add to this, Christy, what is the normal range that you say below which may be abnormal, above which could be abnormal? Because you have to know what the normal range is.
And that completely depends on your level of activity. If you look at the complete dynamic range of heart rate of a human 18-year-old, it's anything from 20 to 180 beats a minute. And that 20 when you're deeply asleep in the middle of the night, and 180 when you're running down to score the final score the final touchdown. Yeah, I am indeed. But so the dynamic range of the human heart rate is enormous. And for me, it's less what the number is than what the situation is. So I think you bring up an excellent point about somebody whose heart races. All heart racing is not normal. If you're running down to score the winning goal at the end of a close football game, then it may be completely normal to have a heart rate of 180. But if you're relaxing and if you're relaxing and suddenly you notice your heart's doing 160, 180 beats a minute, and there's no reason for it to be happening, you're not anxious, you're not disturbed, you're not physically active, then it's likely that that's likely to have an explanation for it, a pathological explanation.
Well, we're going to need to take a short break. When we come back, I think we're going to want to talk about some of these conditions in which it is pathological that are common, things like atrial fibrillation. We're talking with Dr. Paul Muncy. We'll continue talking about our topic, arrhythmias, when we come back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and the NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. Paul Muncy about arrhythmias, which is when the heart is beating in funny ways that aren't normal. And Dr. Muncy, you were talking with us a little bit about helping people distinguish when feeling their heartbeat or palpitations are in a setting that isn't normal. If they're not exercising or not anxious and you're feeling something funny happen. And so how do you advise people on when to seek care exactly, when it's emergent or when they should just sort of casually make an appointment?
I think that's an excellent question. And I think that what it comes down to is how you feel with the palpitations. If your heart starts to race and continues to race for more than, let us say, 10 or 20 minutes, or if you feel sick with it, if you feel ill with it, sweaty, dizzy, you feel like you may be going to fall out, or heaven forbid, if you have any chest pain with it, then that's the time to start thinking about dialing 911 and going to the emergency room. If it's something that you've become aware of, but then you think back that you've probably been doing it for a number of years, or you used to do it a number of years ago, and it's just that your heart's racing and you don't feel quite right with it, but you're not sick with it, then it's perfectly all right to just call up your family doctor and say, well, let's just think about what to do about this. Because if you work with your family doctor, you may be able to establish a diagnosis and get to see the right person to elect on treatment options at an early stage without actually having to go through the traumas of emergency medicine.
Well, how reliable are people's kind of symptoms? If they say that my heart was racing and it's been doing that for 20 seconds every 2 weeks for 3 months, is that a reliable indicator that there might be an arrhythmia like atrial fibrillation occurring intermittently? Maybe we even define what atrial fibrillation is.
Sure. Let's just briefly define what atrial fibrillation is, because that is the commonest rhythm disturbance I deal with. About 5 million Americans at any given time have a diagnosis of atrial fibrillation, much commoner in the older population, but certainly increasingly recognized in people in their 40s and 50s. And this atrial fibrillation occurs when the upper chambers of the heart, the atria, begin to vibrate instead of beat. And you feel that as rapid irregularity of the pulse. And it can either be a condition that's chronic, that's just ongoing all your life, or it can be something that starts and stops. And I think in my world, one of the most important differentiators when I talk to people with arrhythmias between an important pathological arrhythmia and something that is just an adrenaline surge and the heart racing is how the thing starts and how it ends. If it starts just like turning on a light for no good reason at all, just instantly your heart is suddenly racing and irregular, it's much more likely to be a pathological arrhythmia than, for example, an adrenaline surge. You got anxious, you just had a row with your husband or wife or whatever. And if you can also get from people the idea that it stops suddenly, then it's almost certainly a pathological arrhythmia. So it's not so much how long it lasts for or how fast it is, it's what's the chronicity of it, what's the pattern of it.
So with atrial fibrillation that you brought up, there are all kinds of different medicines that we've used over the years to help people's hearts slow down to a more normal rate or to also thin the blood to help prevent a stroke. But there are all kinds of new treatment options and new medicines that have come out. And I know you're at the forefront of all of this. How can you just explain or summarize to us what's really new and cutting edge with the treatment of this?
Sure. I mean, I think atrial fibrillation is one of the fields of medicine where we seem to be making major new discoveries every year. I think the only bad thing that can happen if you have atrial fibrillation is that atrial fibrillation can give you a stroke. And thinning the blood in atrial fibrillation is hugely important in people who are at risk of a stroke. That is a proportion of people with atrial fibrillation. And you may have seen adverts on the commercials on the television recently for new blood thinning medications that will undoubtedly revolutionize the treatment of atrial fibrillation because they don't require blood tests or special diets and things. And they work, if anything, better than the traditional medication Coumadin. But if you look at the really cutting-edge therapies for the disease of atrial fibrillation, really the exciting developments over the last 15 years have really been surgical. In people who are not easily controlled with drugs for atrial fibrillation and people who are very symptomatic with atrial fibrillation, in the vast majority of them, we can offer them a surgical control of the disease. And by surgery, I don't mean by opening their chests. I mean by inserting catheters into the heart through the veins and actually burning out the electrical short circuits in the heart that cause the atrial fibrillation. We can't cure everybody that way, but we can offer a 75 to 80% chance of success in the majority of cases. And even more exciting than that, people that we couldn't treat a year or two ago, even with catheters, we're now starting to be able to offer a realistic solution for, where I work with one of my surgical colleagues, my cardiac surgical colleagues, Dr. Andrew Kaiser, and he puts a telescope into the bag that surrounds the heart called the pericardium. He puts that in through the tummy and can make burns to obliterate the short circuits causing the atrial fibrillation, both from the outside of the heart, and then when he's finished, I can thread instruments through the veins to the inside of the heart, and we can attack the arrhythmia from both sides of the heart. And that's something that's a very minimally invasive operation, even though a surgeon's involved. And we do it just in my own electrophysiology operating room, and the people spend a couple of days in hospital, and the success rate is very high, even in people with very diseased hearts.
You know, one of the questions, I guess, I was surprised when I looked at this a couple of years ago, and tell me if it's true, that unlike maybe with congestive heart failure, coronary artery disease, once you have it, it's clear that you may not live as long of a life as people who don't have it. But I saw something that atrial fibrillation, maybe because of some of these new treatments, that the lifespan is frequently normal if it's controlled and or treated. And is it a different mechanism then that really we can prolong or keep life going pretty much like someone normal?
I think that that's a question that we're in the process of trying to answer. But I would frame it in a slightly different way. I think if you just have atrial fibrillation and there is nothing else wrong with your heart except atrial fibrillation, then this does not shorten your life. If you have something else wrong with your heart,
high blood pressure, yeah, that's driving this,
high blood pressure,
heart disease,
or coronary disease, or cardiac failure, or something like that, then atrial fibrillation can make those diseases more difficult to control. But the prognosis is the prognosis, how well you do in the long term.
If you had atrial fibrillation at a young age, you know, in your 40s, and you had none of these other things, it's a very good prognosis.
Extremely good. And if we fix it and make the symptoms go away, either with drugs or with surgery, it will not impact, so far as we can tell, your longevity. But even more than that, there are hints developing in the literature at the moment that among people with congestive cardiac failure, if we can make the atrial fibrillation go away, we may improve the strength of the heart. And it's as yet unknown, but that may prolong their prognosis.
And so as you develop these techniques, and you are to control the, or to wipe out that electrical signal that tells the heart to beat in a funny way that causes AFib, as you develop those to wipe it out, then you could potentially cure that problem so they wouldn't need those specific medicines to control that rate anymore? Or I guess it depends on the situation.
No, I think that in an increasing proportion of patients, we can make the antiarrhythmic drugs go away and we can make the blood thinning medications go away.
Wow.
That's not in everybody, but as I said, as year follows year follows year, we get better at it. And as we get better at it, an increasing number of people can get off their drugs. I always think when I think about atrial fibrillation surgery and when I talk to patients about atrial fibrillation surgery that what we all want is no arrhythmia, no drugs.
Mm-hmm.
But what a lot of people will take if they have a lot of other things wrong with the heart is no arrhythmia on drugs that didn't used to work.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be a good outcome among selected people, too. What I would like is no arrhythmia, no drugs.
Well, speaking of outcomes, we only have a short time left, but wanted to talk about just one final, real briefly, situation of arrhythmia, and that's really the people you mentioned earlier in the show, you know, sudden death that occurs from an arrhythmia. And being a runner and knowing several people who have had sudden death from running, I always sometimes worry in the heat that we have now. Are there what do we know about sudden death and ways of preventing it? Do I need to worry when I'm exercising in this heat?
I think that we all need to worry when we exercise in this kind of heat that we avoid heat stroke, we keep ourselves adequately hydrated, and that means not just with water but also with high salt things. The kind of things that cause athletes to die suddenly, and for athletes that can be an old fogey like me running.
Yeah, and I wouldn't call myself an athlete. Yeah.
And I wouldn't
an
call
athlete,
myself.
Adam.
But as an increasing number of people run at an age when our parents wouldn't have even thought of running, then we are starting to see people run into trouble. And I think especially in the heat, if you're starting to feel exhaustion, you need to stop. You don't need to be running through it. When people run into serious trouble, sudden cardiac death is something that happens among even recreational athletes. The reason you die is not because you're running. It's because it unmasks a problem, usually in the heart, that you have. And one of the things that we've been doing since I got to the University of North Carolina is, and I and others have been helping to screen the UNC athletes to make sure, for example, that they don't have any unsuspected things wrong with their circulations that might lead them running into trouble, because in elite athletes it can happen at an even younger age.
So just paying attention and common sense measures and paying attention to any warning signs like I'm tired and my heart rate shouldn't go up any further.
Yes, exactly. And we should all know that 80% of 270 minus our age is as high as our heart rate should be going.
Say that again slower.
80% of 270 minus our age.
We'll put that on our blog.
I thought you would.
So for me at 51, that's 219. 80% of 219 would be my maximum.
Yeah, and that would be about in the 160 beats a minute range.
Oh, very useful.
Very,
well, listen,
very useful.
We've been talking with Dr. Paul Muncy, UNC School of Medicine, Division of Cardiology, about arrhythmias. Thank you so much for being our guest today.
Thank you. I've enjoyed talking to you.
Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show, Adam and I are going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns. And we've got some good ones today.
Yeah, Christy, you know, we're getting increasing numbers of questions and comments from listeners. They can send them to yourhealth@unc.edu. And let's listen to our very first question today about saunas and heat and its therapeutic use for healing.
So I love to go to the hot springs or sit in the saunas and all of those. And I'm wondering, is there any benefit to health? I know it feels good, but what does it do?
Well, you're not alone in that. I like to go, I don't know about hot springs. I'm not around hot springs too much, but I like to go to saunas. I just joined a fitness center. And, you know, your question was a really good one because it got me thinking about it. What's the benefits and what are the risks?
Well, and I went in one recently and there's a huge sign right outside the door. Do not go in if you have heart problems or if you're pregnant.
If you have heart problems, there's a lot of things we probably shouldn't do. There should be warning signs before going into some of the movie theaters.
Right, exactly. And if you're pregnant, it's probably not a great idea.
You go on the roller coaster.
But really,
what about this? What do we know about saunas and steam? What are the real risks? And then I've looked at some information about potential benefits.
Well, I think you have to think about overheating and making sure you're keeping your fluids in and you're not getting sort of a heat stroke type situation from being dehydrated for that long, kind
of
cooking your body.
We saw those situations from those kind of the people out in Arizona who were forced to stay in these hot environments for way too long, and they actually died. So we know that those things can happen if you really go too overboard in how long you stay in these things.
But there are some potential health benefits, particularly around pain syndromes. What else do we know, Adam?
Yeah, you know, people with chronic pain, people with fibromyalgia, using water therapy with sauna therapy has been helpful. There's some really interesting research about maybe endurance for competitive athletes. They can recover quicker and perform better the next day if they have a brief sauna experience. Even some interesting on quality of life improvement for people with chronic diseases. You know, I don't know if we have the research, Christy, about people with common colds or something more chronic, like chronic heart disease, if, you know, the safety or the benefits. But there's good research that it can help some people in some of their conditions.
Well, and for me, it's a stress reducer. You go in there,
absolutely,
you can't talk, you can't do your email, you just have to sit there, and it sort of forces you to relax. I don't know.
Yeah,
for
well,
me,
I think I think the biggest thing is bring a towel in there when you sit down. Sit on something, you know, so you don't burn yourself either. But this is a good question. Thank you so much. And let's listen to our very next house call today about another really interesting question about alcohol and pregnancy.
Hi, I have a question for your health. I know that it used to be that no alcohol at all was allowed if you're pregnant. And I've heard that recently there might be some differences on that you could have a sip or two of wine. So I was just wondering what your information on that is.
That is a great question and a really difficult one. I mean, this is a question that we get regularly as physicians, and I take care of patients in their prenatal care. And, you know, it's a tough thing to answer because we really don't have a safe amount of alcohol that we can say, if you drink this amount, then it's totally safe. And we do know that drinking consistent alcohol or drinking heavy amounts can be very harmful to a baby's development and their brain and their facial bones and other problems. So it's a really slippery slope. And the message generally that we say is don't drink.
Yeah. And though if we're going to be perfectly honest, we would also say that there really is no data that drinking small amounts of alcohol increases the risk. But you're absolutely right, Christy. Doctors, particularly worried about malpractice and adverse outcomes, are not going to recommend or tell you that it's safe to drink. But if, again, we're going to be fully disclosed, we should also say that there isn't evidence that small amounts. And so I think sharing at least what we know and what we don't know, allowing some people to really make those decisions without us recommending something is maybe okay for some people.
And it's sort of the beginning of parenting. You're making these choices that, I mean, there are lots of things that we know are harmful to children, but you have to make your own parenting decisions. People have different level of risk. And so for some people, taking a sip of alcohol is, you know, really, really stressful. For other people, they know about themselves. They couldn't take a sip. They'd start drinking heavily, and that would be very dangerous. So,
yeah, I mean, if you told me as a pregnant woman that you were having a half a glass of wine periodically, would I say to stop it? I may not recommend it, but I may not say to stop it either. Versus you and others, and I could certainly see doctors saying, "Well, I don't recommend it," and just leaving it at that.
Yeah, well, I usually say I don't recommend you drink anything and sort of talk about fetal alcohol syndrome and say, but, you know, you make your own choices. If you have a sip here or there, that's your choice.
Yeah. Well, it's a very good question. I hope our answer at least sheds a little light on it, but maybe
sorry,
the question's
so
even
fuzzy.
Better than the answer. But let's listen to our very next question about caffeine and safety.
Hi, I have a question for your health. My question is, how much caffeine is safe to drink in a typical day?
Good question.
That's a good question, especially coming from a caffeine lover. I drink my coffee every morning and will not give it up.
How much? How much coffee would you say you
I have. I've actually cut back a little bit, but I have a huge cup of coffee every morning.
Yeah, and her hands right now are about 2 feet apart.
It's big. And I used to drink 1.5, and I just recently cut it down to 1.
So that 1 might have 2 cups of coffee in it?
Yeah, it's at least 2 cups. It's probably 2.5 if you measure regular cups. And then
so
I have 1 soda a day.
A normal cup of coffee might have 100 milligrams of caffeine in it. And I know from my own experience, if I have more than 3 cups of caffeinated coffee, not decaf, because decaf you could probably drink almost as much as you want. But if I had more than 3 cups of caffeinated coffee, I start feeling a little bit sometimes jittery, or as I would say, my eye can twitch.
Well,
not a good thing.
And it's hard also to recommend to people because different coffees, based on how they're made,
mm-hmm.
you know, instant coffee is about 100 milligrams, filter coffee is about 140. One of those energy drinks is about 80 milligrams. So, I mean, and everything you get has a little – it's made a little differently. They're not all standard amounts
moderation.
Of caffeine. Yeah, that's
moderation,
the answer.
Moderation, you know. 3 cups for some people, 5 probably. If you get much more than 5, I don't think any doctor that we would know would recommend that that's healthy. But there's nothing necessarily wrong with 3 cups of coffee a day for if you're not having problems like reflux or other sorts of acid or problems.
Yeah, I think at whatever point you're starting to have trouble, either trouble sleeping, trouble feeling jittery, that is too much.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about our last house call, Christy, about sun protection factor. And can you use last year's sunscreen?
Hi, I have a question for Dr. Page and Dr. Goldstein. So what's the loss in SPF protection when you use last year's sunscreen?
This is such a good question because I always save my sunscreen. And I haven't really thought about how it loses effectiveness over time.
Well, the manufacturers will certainly say don't use it if it's more than a year old. I don't know of any research that really has looked at this. Maybe we can see if we can post something on our website, if we can find something. So we're not necessarily going to recommend it. But I'll tell you what. If any of our listeners out there can maybe write us, tell us your own experiences with this, and you could do a controlled experiment. Put sunscreen on one arm from a year ago, put the one from this year on the other arm, and let us know. Don't get a bad burn. But, you know, because it is expensive, and I could understand that, but some medicines do lose their effectiveness. So we're not going to recommend it, but maybe you can tell us your own experiences.
I would agree with that.
And that's going to conclude our house calls today. We've had a chance to talk about sun protection factor and caffeine.
Talk a little bit about alcohol and pregnancy and about saunas.
Well, thank you so much for joining us for Your Health. We hope we've addressed through this show questions and concerns that are important to you. You can email us at yourhealth@unc.edu. Visit us online at yourhealthradio.org.
And you can visit us on iTunes, get free podcasts of the show, and you can also find us on Twitter and Facebook.
So we'd like to thank WCHL, UNC Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Paul Mouncey.
And we hope you'll join us next time on Your Health. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and we'll talk to you again next week. Bye-bye.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360 WCHL. 1360 WCHL wants to connect with you online for updates on our lifestyle programs, awesome giveaways, contests, trivia, community photos, breaking news, and more. Follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/chapelboro and become our fan on Facebook, and always connect with us online at chapelboro.com.